This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David E. Kelly made TV history on Sunday when he became the first producer to win Emmys for Best Drama and Comedy in the same year. The dramatic series is The Practice. The comedy is Ally McBeal. Kelly wrote all 22 episodes of Ally McBeal's past season and 17 episodes of The Practice. In The Practice, there's been a continuing struggle within the law firm about how to get away from defending drug dealers and how to become more respected and successful. In this scene, two of the firm's lawyers, Eleanor and Lindsay, meet in the newly decorated conference room after the firm rejected getting involved with a big asbestos case that Eleanor had brought in.
Do you see this here? Do you know what this is, Lindsay? A table. It's not just a table. It's a piece of across the street. The high-rise firms with the big clients and the libraries and the computers.
Clients who don't kill people.
It is a piece of across the street that you have been chasing. Bobby, I knew his vote. He has some success phobia that none of us will ever understand. But you, this new client, is exactly our ticket to admission to the other world that you want. And by you voting to turn it down tells me that you are either more concerned with your own success than that of the firm's, or you are suddenly under the influence of Bobby's bed covers. Either way, I have got a big problem.
Are you done?
For now.
First of all, this table never represented a world where we represent
that
companies.
That isn't what...
You said you were done.
It has nothing to do with this client.
You said you were done.
You just don't like the idea of anyone besides you bringing in a blue chip.
It's about the client.
We don't have to do it forever.
It's not who we are. It's not who you are, unless you're under some new influence.
Please,
but don't tell me who I am. Are you somebody who wants to cross-examine widows every day, saying, hey, maybe your husband had the flu?
You have never even tried one of these cases.
Every day, your job will be to wear them down. I don't care. You'll be the victim eventually.
To say that we have to live up to Lindsay Dole's moral standards of what cases we take or not.
Nothing to do with me or Bobby.
The day I let you judge me will be the day that I walk out of his office.
Hey!
I tried keeping him out, honest.
Eleanor, in my office.
Oh, go to hell!
David E. Kelly actually practiced law for 3 years, during which time he wrote a movie called From the Hip. That movie led Steve Bochco to hire him as a writer for the first season of L.A. Law. Kelly went on to create Picket Fences and Chicago Hope, which he followed with Ally McBeal and The Practice. Today we feature an interview with Kelly, conducted by Brian Lowry. He writes about television for the L.A. Times and is the author of two books about the X-Files. Their interview was recorded in June at the Writers Guild conference called Words into Pictures. This fall, Kelly will be working on Ally McBeal, The Practice, and Chicago Hope, as well as his new series, Snoops, and the new half-hour version of Ally McBeal. Brian Lowry asked Kelly how he could juggle all that without spreading himself too thin.
This year, I'm going to have to focus on my ability to read scripts, look at somebody else's script, give notes on somebody else's script to make their script better. And that's something that I've been a little incompetent at over the past. When I get a script that hasn't been right, it's always been more economically time efficient for me to say, well, I know what it is in my head and let me take a stab at that scene and write it. I can do that fortunately or unfortunately faster than I can sit down and explain what it is I'm looking for in the scene and send someone else off to write it. But with this many shows going at the same time, really I have no choice but to develop that skill or I will be spread too thinly.
Mm-hmm. People have probably read about this, but just in case they haven't, you do write on a long legal pad. And
I do.
Longhand on a legal pad.
Yes, it sounds so romantic, but you get this big bump on your finger by the end of the year.
How does that process work? Do you write an Ally McBeal script all the way till it's done? Will you stop in the middle of an alley and pick up?
I try to be on one thing at a time, yeah. There are is occasionally, while I'm writing an Ally McBeal, I'll get notice that the practice script is short and stop shooting tomorrow, so we need one more scene. So I'll put down the pen on Ally and then look at the practice script. But that's rare. Usually I'm on one show at a time, and when I'm working on Allie, the practice really doesn't even exist for those 3 or 4 days. And it's the same when I'm writing the practice. Allie is pushed out. The irony is that when I come back to write a show for either of the series, I feel like I have been away from it longer than I might feel if I were only writing one show. I remember doing Picket Fences the first year. After you write Fade Out at the end, the last thing you could do is start up another script. And it feels like you just have to get away from those characters for a day or two or three. And then coming back to start the next script after those 2 days or 3 days, it feels like you really weren't away for a long enough period of time. But the byproduct of writing two shows is by the time I finish one, it feels like I've been away from the other for a long time. And for some odd reason, I feel more refreshed in terms of attacking the next script on the other series.
And not to...
So everybody should write two series.
Just to make sure the hostility in the room is complete, how long does it normally take you to...
Well... Four days is the best. Five... and I know people don't like hearing this, but I when I have a week or something, the scripts usually aren't as good. 2 days, they're also not as good. I pick things up in the rewrite that obviously were a product of being rushed, and so 2 days isn't enough time. Sometimes you have to do it in that amount of time at the end of the season, and I find those scripts I probably rewrite more. But for me, the scripts that ultimately are the worst and need the most work are the ones I have the most time on. And the only explanation I have for it is that without the adrenaline of a deadline sort of working on me as I write, there's a resulting lack of adrenaline in some of the scenes. The scripts feel a little more flabby than the ones where I have a shorter amount of time. Mm.
Talk a little bit about when you're doing two shows and when shows start getting into their second and third years, how you keep them fresh. It seems like one of the challenges that you face with a series, and you might want to compare this to writing a feature script, is that you have to sort of advance the characters while still having them run in place a little bit.
Every year during hiatus in June and July, you're just amazed at how many stories there are left to tell with your characters. And every March, you're just stunned that there are none and that there and that there never will be ever again. I remember in L.A. Law the second year when the writer's strike hit, we were on show 20, and secretly within the walls at Fox, we were all looking at each other and said, we've been saved. We won't be found out that there were no more stories ever to tell. Because the idea machine just sort of gets tired. The ultimate pacifier I have in terms of stories is the fact that you've got characters that you're really telling your stories about. So you don't have to be plot-driven with every single story. You have the luxury of being able to tell stories about people that don't have to be as grand or as big as they might in the feature world. A story is always more interesting if it happens to somebody you know. So a smaller story takes on added significance when it happens to somebody that they already care about, as opposed to a feature world, you're introducing new characters. So you've got to move plot at the same time you're introducing character. And as a result, sometimes the concepts have to be bigger than they would in an ongoing television series. The other thing you have in television is if you have six or seven characters in each show, exponentially you have about 30 or 40 different combinations of relationships. For example, in The Practice, I have Bobby Donnell, played by Dylan McDermott. I have Cameron Manheim, Eleanor Frett, played by Cameron. Then I have Kelly Williams playing Lindsay Dole. I can have Lindsay and Bobby, Lindsay and Eleanor, and then Lindsay, Eleanor, and Bobby all in the same room. And they're all very different dynamics depending on the personalities that you have in the room. So it gives you a lot of storytelling license. And as a result, you know, we're going into year four in The Practice and year three on Ally. And I feel that we're just beginning with a lot of the characters. So that's one nice thing about series television. You can peel back layers as you go on. And the idea of, oh my God, I've got to write 100 episodes with these people isn't quite as daunting as it might seem.
Well, and you've also bring in characters, it seems, each season, like Lucy Liu's character, Portia de Rossi. On The Practice, Lucy character.
Right, as well as recurring characters. We had a judge played by Holland Taylor on The Practice that the viewers sort of took to immediately. It was something about the way she scratched out Lindsay's face that caused our public to say, yes, I identify with her. So you never know.
Well, actually, I was going to get to that much later, but since you brought her up, that was probably the most memorable line of the year, even though it wasn't the line you wrote initially, I guess. But when she said to in the deposition that she gave him the best fellatio known to mankind, which I believe originally was the best blowjob known to mankind, and that sort of raises the issue. I suspect you don't get a lot of interference from the network, but what kind of interference and editing and notes you get from the network, and also in that context, because you've taken on a lot of subjects like religion. You had a rabbi accused of rape in The Practice this year. What their concerns as far as interest groups and those sorts of issues are.
Both Fox and ABC have been very supportive, and I think the unwritten rule is if you deal with the subject responsibly, we'll let you go there. That particular word was one that I had never tried to utilize or put in a series before. But the truth is, with this character, the story was about a judge being sued by a law clerk for not getting a glowing recommendation. And the reveal was that the judge had an ongoing affair with this law clerk in her chambers. And in the course of the deposition, she was describing what went on in chambers. And this judge decided that she would go beyond having her answers be legally accurate and actually come up to the level of being truthful. This judge, it was in her character to really be sort of blunt and not try to dance around it. So she said it like it was. ABC would not allow it, although the ABC Entertainment Division fought very hard for it. And they felt strongly that word was more germane to this judge's character than fellatio. And they actually went to bat for us and said that it really should remain. We shot it both ways, and the Entertainment Division continued to fight for it. But the Broadcast Standards side, I don't think they call themselves Broadcast Standards anymore.
I
but
think they do.
Do they?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just like one guy now because
right.
They cut the budget.
They drew the line in the sand on that one and said, you can't have it. NYPD Blue hasn't even used that word.
Well, would have been and a nice also, way to one-up Bosco.
Actually, the example they cited that I was really stumped for, any kind of rejoinder, is that word pops up on Politically Incorrect all the time, and they bleep it out. And that's at 11:30 at night or even 12:30 in some markets. And if they have to tell Bill Maher no for a program that airs at 12:30, how could they tell me yes? And I was, well, that's a good point. So we went with the other.
We're listening to David E. Kelly in conversation with Brian Lowry at the Writers Guild Conference in Los Angeles. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to David E. Kelly in conversation with Brian Lowry, who writes about TV for the LA Times. Kelly was once quoted as saying that viewers looking for tidy or easy answers should flip the channel rather than watch his shows. Lowry asked Kelly if he wants to challenge viewers.
We kind of delude ourselves. We have this picture of our viewer, and our viewers sort of unplug the phones and, you know, tie the kids to the bedposts in the room so they can't come out, and watch from beginning to end, and pay attention. That's the kind of ideal viewer that we hope to be sitting in front of the television. I realize that it doesn't always quite work that way, and I don't think we're alone. I think most television producers are in a little bit of denial over the way that the majority of people do watch television, and that the dishwasher is running, they get pulled away from the television, they don't see the whole show from beginning to end. That's where I'm probably the most envious of the feature world. I don't really have a great desire to go into features because I like writing about characters, and I think television is still the best place to unearth and sort of explore character. But I get very jealous when I go into a movie theater and it has Dolby Stereo, the lights go out, people actually stop talking, the sound and the picture is beautiful, and they watch the product the way you want it to be watched. I was just home visiting my parents in April, and there's, you know, my parents, they're devoted to my shows, you know. They have to be. I think it's a law in Florida, your children. But the practice came on, and my father had like 3 cheeseburgers at 9 o'clock. He'd fallen asleep by 9:20. My mother spent about from 9:20 to about 9:27. I mean, 10:20 to 10:27, trying to wake him. Then she didn't really believe or understand or accept why this character continued to cry during Act 3. And I said, Mom, she lost her spouse in Act 2. And oh. And I realized that's television watching to a large extent. You wouldn't believe how we sit and agonize in a dark editing room over a music cue. We think, now this music is too hip. Let's dial this back. We want to suggest that, but we don't want to hear it. And then you realize that the music cue is being drowned out by a garbage disposal half the time anyway. But I think it's much worse, and there are some producers who do think this way, I think it's much worse to sit in that room cynical or jaded and say, you know what, they're not really going to pay attention anyway, so just up the music there and fill that 30 seconds with a walk and talk. The audience won't care. Half of them will be urinating anyway. So just do this. They're all stupid. And there are producers, I think, who get lazy that way. And I think that the luckiest break I got in this business was my very first job out here was working for Stephen Bochco. And the habits that I picked up working for him, I think I still hold very dear, because Stephen never writes down to an audience, never assumes that people won't be there asking hard questions or demanding that you do better. That bit of mentoring, I clung hold to and still do. And I think if you look at the best shows that are on television today, Homicide, it was on yesterday, but it's not on. But people like Tom Fontana and Steven, Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz, they're people who really, really respect their audience. And I think that that's the first and best lesson that any writer producer can adhere to when they start to do a television series.
David E. Kelley in conversation with Brian Lowry at the Writers Guild Conference in June. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview with David E. Kelley, creator of the TV series Ally McBeal and The Practice, which just won Emmys for Best Comedy and Dramatic Series. Kelley's new series, Snoops, premieres this fall. He also created Chicago Hope and Picket Fences. We're listening to the interview he recorded in June at the Writers Guild conference called Words into Pictures. Kelley was interviewed by Brian Lowry, who also took some questions from the audience. Lowry reports on the TV industry for the LA Times.
We did a story about the lack of minority characters on the new shows that are going on in the fall. Your shows tend to be seemingly fairly effortlessly integrated. And I wonder, one, if that's something that you consciously do, and two, if it's how you feel about the rest of the marketplace.
Well, in terms of our shows, I can't say I sit down and write black characters or Jewish characters or Asian characters. I mainly write characters and then go about casting the best actor. We keep some sense in the back of our mind that we'd like it to be multicultural and have an open eye to that. And if we can make it multicultural, all things being even, maybe we will. But I don't sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write a black character to fill in here and a Jewish character to fit in there. Some of the characters have been, their ethnicity has just been a product of who we have cast. Eleanor Frutt, for example, wasn't written as Jewish. Cameron Mannheim was cast and the character became Jewish. With my shows, I think it's probably characters who happen to be ethnic as opposed to starting with an intent of ethnicity and then going, writing the character around it. As far as the general landscape is, I have to confess, I don't see that much television. I have two small children, so by the time I put them to bed, I usually go to bed myself. So I guess I should declare myself incompetent to answer that part.
There's several questions that I'll just kind of integrate into one. A lot of people seem to want to know what you do for fun, and which I guess watching television we know isn't part of that. But and how you integrate with the schedule that you keep having a personal life into that.
My schedule isn't that bad, believe it or not. I get to the office about 9 and leave about 6. When I come home, it's basically with the children until they go to bed about 8:30 or 9. And I must confess, as I get older, I'm kind of whipped now by 9 o'clock. I used to be able to stay up a little bit later, watch Nightline. Now I have the dish, so I can watch it at 8:30 from the New York feed. For fun, I still love sports. I played hockey every Thursday night in a league, which was fun really kind of until about this year when just the players somehow got faster. It's an over 30 league. When I joined the league, I was 30, and it was a slower league. And now they're not even respectful as they pass by me. So it was less fun. A bunch of us are looking now for an over 35 league. If we can find that, I think hockey will once again become fun. But in terms of, I don't bungee jump or do any of those things. Probably my favorite hobby is going to the movies. We try to go to the movies every Saturday night. That's my wife and I, that's our date night. And the kids.
You're pretty dull.
I know, yeah. I know. There was a few years ago, Time Magazine was going to do some article after, I think, Picket Fences won the Emmy. And they called various people who knew me, and they called me too. And they canceled the article on account of dullness. They said, it's just, there's nothing interesting there. He eats hamburgers and he plays hockey. That's not enough.
Well, there was an LA Times Sunday Magazine piece, and one of the things that some of the people talked about is that you will sort of drift off in the midst of conversation, and or will suddenly they will realize that you are plotting three scripts while you're in the middle of talking to them.
That's true, and some people are gifted at getting me to think of other things other than what they're saying. I know there's a joke at the office that I have kind of attention deficit disorder when it comes to meetings, because I absolutely zone out. That's why I will never be a director. I know that what a character wears is important, that fashion is part of the show, and that props in the back of the sets, that they do have something to do with what's going on. But I have absolutely no attention capacity for it. And if I'm not writing the script, if it's not about that or about editing, I'm quite bored with much of the other stuff that goes on. Even casting. Other than casting the regular roles, I don't even get involved in that. So many people think, oh, that must be so much fun when you write something, and then people come in and you just get to listen to them read it, and what a feeling that must give you. It's next to death. It's first of all, being trapped in a room with your own words. It suddenly points out everything that's wrong with the scene, and then you're not done. Another one comes in and reads the scene again. I like to go to read-throughs because I get it all in one. Okay, it sounds horrible. Okay, and I can go change it, but it's not like the Chinese drip where I have to keep doing it over and over again.
We're listening to David E. Kelley in conversation with Brian Lowry, recorded in June at the Writers Guild Conference. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview with David E. Kelley, conducted by LA Times TV writer Brian Lowry. Let's hear a scene from Ally McBeal. In this scene from Kelley's series, Ally, played by Calista Flockhart, and her roommate, assistant DA Renee Raddick, played by Lisa Nicole Carson, discuss their love lives over lunch.
Maybe we are the weaker sex. I mean, isn't that what these laws are saying?
No, they're saying men shouldn't harass us.
Well, why do we need the laws? Why can't we just stick up for ourselves?
Using the law is sticking up
for
yourself.
Well, what I don't get is that society tells us to be weak. Society tells us that we have to be the demurring gender. And if we're ever the sexual predators, well, that is just unseemly, isn't it? Well, it isn't fair. We have to sit back and wait to be asked out, wait to be called.
This must be about Greg again.
If guys don't take no for an answer, if guys are persistent, well, whether we think that's romantic. We make movies about them. But if it's a woman, they cast Glenn Close.
How many times have you called him?
Who?
Greg.
A few. 11. Here's the problem, Renee, and it's every bit as much yours as it is mine. There are no good men. Now I read this article, and on average, there are 2 per state.
Good men?
Yes, and I had one of them. And I let him get away.
There's actually a law student out there who wants to know if you're concerned about what your shows do in terms of the image of lawyers. And in terms that people will draw some of their perceptions of lawyers from what they see on the show.
Well,
fish comes to mind, but.
I think if any lawyer tried to make a claim that we were undermining the reputation of lawyers as a whole, either as people or characters, they would probably lose. Because I think that our people, even though they do crazy and eccentric things, are all very good people at the end of the day, even fish. And I think that pro rata, we have a higher population of humanitarians and good people in our office complexes than you might find in regular law firms. I think, you know, there are good and bad people in every profession. But if you look at, if you start with the practice, for example, these people are constantly sort of struggling with their ethical centers and moral centers. And even though they get lost from time to time, they are endeavoring to struggle with it, which a lot of lawyers don't. A lot of lawyers say that the easiest way to do this profession is let's get rid of that debate and stick the ethical pulls and ties in the closet, at least until after I've made partner. And then with Allie, I always kind of recoil at the idea that we're representing anybody other than these characters, because they're so strange. And it's not a real law firm. I mean, have you ever seen a timesheet in Allie McBeal? I mean, nobody works. The law firm there is really just a franchise to come up with stories and ideas that get to unfold little nuances of the people who live there.
I have several cards in here, and you're sort of a writer's nightmare when you write 39 out of 44 episodes of your 2 shows, but several people wanted to know what you look for when you meet with a writer, if it's possible to get in and pitch you, and if there's any way to pitch you or anybody without an agent.
Well, I can never tell in a meeting whether somebody's a good writer or not. Some producers can, and I don't even have meetings really for that purpose. I'll look at the script first, because it's not just a function of being smart. There's a lot of hugely intelligent people who I sit down in a room who are much smarter than I am, and if it's simply about a person being intelligent and articulate, I could fill my studio with smart people. Writing, I feel, is as much an ear as it is anything else. It certainly helps to be intelligent as well as probably educated, but to me it's the ear, it's the rhythms of how people speak, whether it sounds the way people talk, whether there's a flow in scenes, whether the writer is able to find conflict in the scenes, and a general story gut of just when you finish one scene, are you anxious to get to the next scene to see what happens next? They're very inexact, unscientific talents, and the only way you can tell if somebody can do it is really to read the script. So that's the ticket. If the script is impressive, then the meeting would follow. But it's you know, the thing about writing is you may never have written anything in your life, and you can do it. But a lot of people are probably good writers who have never tried it, and there are other people that have been doing it for 20 years and perhaps should stop. And it's not a function of intelligence. It's a function of story sense and an ear for dialogue.
A couple of specific questions about the shows. I assume George Vogelman's story will continue into next season.
Well, we're working on that one, yes.
And with Chicago Hope, you came in to do the final episode mm-hmm. this year, and I think we're going to do the first couple right. next year. It was obviously a pretty dramatic change in sort of firing everybody in the hospital. What prompted that?
What prompted it really was that it was in critical condition in terms of being renewed itself, and in fact, the likelihood was it was not going to come back next fall. And I had a meeting with Les Moonves at CBS, and at the outset of the meeting, it became clear that the only chance it had was for it to really be reinvented, which I was willing to do because I believe that the show did have some life left in it. And there were 10 regular characters on the show, and I knew probably 6 would have to leave. So we did it all in one scene. It was very arbitrary. The script actually reflected the same level of capriciousness that was in my head and pen when I did it. I remember asking John Tinker, the executive producer, is there anybody who wants to go? Because it could have been anybody. I knew I could keep 4, and 6 had to go. And it was hard. It's a cruel enough business anyway. And for actors to, you know, devote their lives to a series for 3 or 4 years, and then in one scene, I mean, I didn't give them a goodbye scene. They didn't even... There wasn't even a scene really saying, gee, it's sad to see you go. Mandy Patinkin's character came in and said, gone, bye, boom. When you're firing 6 of them, that was really the only way I could think, because if I were going to give them each their what was deserved, it would have been kind of a melancholy experience.
We're listening to David E. Kelly in conversation with Brian Lowry, recorded in June at the Writers Guild Conference. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to TV producer David E. Kelly in conversation with Brian Lowry, who writes about TV for the LA Times.
The half-hour Ally McBeal, which is really an interesting experiment, what inspired that, and how exactly is that going to be? Is it going to be minus the courtroom scenes? How's it going to play?
It depends on the episode. The inspiration, I'm sad to say, was probably business. It started with Ally McBeal coming up for syndication. No one wanted to buy it. There was just one... Lifetime was really the only serious buyer for it, which was okay. You know, I've never ever developed a series with the idea of syndication anyway. But then I started hearing the reasons that people didn't want to buy it. And the reasons were that, oh, you know, it's just too hot right now. And it's these meteoric kind of shows quickly fade, and these shows will feel very dated very quickly. And the way it was dismissed then started really just to get me angry. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm looking at some of these half hours, and I think this doesn't make sense to me. And I thought I could cut Ally McBeal into a half hour and it would have more story, more character, and probably be funnier than some of these half hours that are commanding all this respect. So I think it's a bit of a competitive part in me too that wanted to prove that they're wrong. So I started trying it in my free time, cutting some of the hours down to half hours. And to my surprise, not only did some of them play well, some of them actually played better than the hour. Because what I was doing was crunching the comedic scenes and taking out some of the, you know, closing arguments, the long scenes. And as a half hour, they started to play pretty quickly with pretty good pace to it. And I thought they were pretty funny. So I proposed the idea to Fox, because Fox is my partner in it all, and they were really in charge of the syndication. I proposed the idea that, you know, they cut them in half and go out to syndication as half hours. I also believe that when people watch shows in syndication, they're around the dinner hour and a lot of things are going on, and so the emotional storylines or the serious storylines kind of get lost anyway. So I thought, you know, just take a look at these. Maybe you want to syndicate it as a half hour, and I gave them four episodes. And they came back excited and wanted to actually program it, which at first scared me a little bit, but then I thought, no, you know what, I'm proud enough of them as half hours. I think that they're entertaining and they're fun. Why not let people see them? So.
And is there any concern that it's going to detract in any way from the 1 hour?
Well, yes, there's this concern, but at the end of the day, the analysis, which you know is always 100% right, is that probably would have a net positive effect. You run the risk of overexposure, but to the extent that Fox does better on Tuesday night than they otherwise would, you might get more exposure and promotion for your hour show. And ultimately, we just decided to do it.
Well, we're down to probably what is the last question, so I'll try to be as global and sweeping as possible. But you made a transition from another career to becoming a writer. And one, what advice, if any, you would have to someone who's doing something else who wanted to write, and just sort of the effect of having experience in another field before becoming a writer, just any advice you'd have to anyone who's trying to do that?
Well, do it because you love it. Don't do it because you think it's a great gig. It's if you don't really love writing, then more times than not, you're probably not going to be that successful at it. In terms of living another life or experiencing another career before, I think it helps. I don't think I would be a writer if I was not a lawyer. I think it was sort of 3 years living in sort of a real corporate world. Also, just it was a turf that felt my own when I came out here. I mean, I'm sure I started on LA Law in addition to me having a sense of that turf itself. It probably gave me a confidence that I had been there. And that confidence, I think, probably I applied in the scenes that I wrote that had nothing to do with law lawyers. I've heard the criticism that there are too many young writers that have no life experiences to draw on, that they're really only drawing on other television shows or movies they have seen. I don't know whether it's a real one or not, but I don't think anyone has ever been hurt as a writer by having too much life experience. I didn't become a writer until I was 30 years old. So there's no time you have. It's not like, you know, professional baseball. If you were going to take up the sport at 30, I wouldn't encourage you to think you're ultimately going to pitch for the Yankees. But in writing, it's an innate thing, what we talked about before, a story sense and an ear. And that can be there. It may take a while to cultivate it and get it out, but it can be there.
Well, I think we didn't get through all of these, but I think we touched on almost everything. And thank you for letting me hold your attention.
TV producer David E. Kelly in conversation with Brian Lowry, who reports on the TV industry for the LA Times. Kelly's new series, Snoops, premieres September 26th. He wrote the new movie, Mystery Alaska, which premieres October 1st.